Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the fallout from the publication of the Panama Papers in Russia by the only independent newspaper that the Kremlin does not control, Novaya Gazeta, and speak with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, a defense analyst and regular commentator on Russian domestic and foreign policy with Novaya Gazeta, which the Kremlin is threatening to shut down. We'll discuss why the Russian people support Putin and do not consider him corrupt, even though his best friend, a humble cellist, has $2 billion stashed offshore in Panama, added to which are the revelations in the Panama Papers that the wife of Putin spokesman Dmitry Peskov registered an offshore shell company in the British Virgin Islands. Then we'll speak with a former priest, civil rights worker, anti-war activist and community organizer, James Carroll, a distinguished writer in residence at New York University and author of a number of bestsellers, the latest of which is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age. We will discuss his latest article at The New Yorker, The New Morality of Pope Francis, and Pope Francis's latest apostolic exhortation, The Joy of Love. That is more of a call for love to prevail over judgment than a change in the Catholic Church's rules, many of which the laity ignore, as it welcomes divorced couples back while turning no one away. Then finally, we'll get an update on how the new rules on returning refugees agreed to by the EU and Turkey are turning Greece into a holding pen for asylum seekers who are becoming increasingly desperate as they face deportation back to Turkey. Daryl Grisgraber, who heads Refugees International Research and Advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, dealing mainly with the Syrian displacement crisis, joins us to discuss the human cost of the EU-Turkey deal and how the lack of an overall European refugee policy poses a greater danger to the EU itself. And joining us now from Moscow is Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences. And from 1994 to 2005, he published a regular column on defense in the English language local daily, The Moscow Times. 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. His regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer.
Hello.
So your newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, I understand is under some pressure from the Kremlin. You have in-house, I guess, the so-called Panama Papers. And at this point, where does this standoff with the Kremlin, with Putin, how is it now in terms of whether or not you're going to be shut down?
Well, the newspaper has been under constant pressure because it's an outright opposition publication with rather sizable print run of over 200,000 copies, published three times a week. And, well, of course, the Kremlin doesn't like it much. There's been always inherent pressure on private companies not to put any kind of advertisements in the newspaper to cut off money supply. And there have been different kind of investigations by the authorities where we get the money, and the Justice Ministry. Now, after the publication of the Panama Papers, there have been calls from the Duma, by a deputy there to pro-government to for the prosecutors to investigate the finances of Novaya Gazeta, that they are getting money from abroad, from some kind of foundations, and that that something should be done about that. And I know that the newspaper has been spending a lot of time providing tons of different kinds of documents on all our financial doings. And though the journalists don't get, still get paid, though the pay is not very big, but still it's going on, and the paper is still publishing. But there is, of course, pressure. Up to now, has not closed the publication of Novaya Gazeta, Hopefully that will continue. So, but the pressure is there, and there's the threat all the time.
And when President Putin goes on national television and tells the Russian people that the Panama Papers are a sort of a CIA effort to destabilize Russia, is that widely believed by the Russian public?
Well, that means that the authorities, I mean, different kind of prosecutors and other parts of the bureaucracy get the signal that Novaya Gazeta is in league with the CIA and the State Department in trying to destabilize Russia. That means that they're going to try and find different pretexts to impede with our journalistic work. Will they get the kind of final order to just simply close down the paper on this or that pretext? I don't know. I mean, if they really want to, they can do it. But will they do it or not, and when, again, we don't know. We're just continuing working in the assumption that we'll continue working until it's possible.
And the fact that former Secretary General Mikhail Gorbachev is a minority owner of Novaya Gazeta, isn't he? Does that act as a kind of protection, or is Gorbachev...
Well, not really. He's not very popular with the authorities at present. Mm-hmm. He's not in a conflict direct with the Kremlin, but not that it would really help very much. And a lot of guys in the Russian nomenclatura believed that he was the villain who, together with the American Secret Services, dissolved the Soviet Union. So I don't think that that's much of a kind of guarantee of anything.
Well, boy, it's pretty hard to believe that the CIA could be that clever. Knowing a few people that used to work for them, it's hard to believe that anybody could believe that they...
That's how it's seen from here.
Right.
That's what the president says, that this is all special service work.
Right.
And apparently he believes, I mean, Putin, that the Panama Papers could have been a declaration of war, that the Washington has decided on a regime change in Moscow and has right now kind of moved from planning to actual execution of that operation. This is the first shots in that war.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is in Moscow, where he is a defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously was a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences and has been an independent defense analyst on the staff of Novaya Gazeta, a newspaper the only independent newspaper left inside Russia that's now under threat of closure because of their publication of the Panama Papers. It's hard to believe, Dr. Felgenhauer, that the Russian public somehow excuse Vladimir Putin when all around him the Siloviki and the oligarchs are stealing billions. In this case, he's his best friend, the guy that is the godfather of his daughter, that actually introduced Putin to his wife. The cellist, a humble cellist, is able to stash a couple of billion dollars in Panama. And so how is it that the public in Russia hate the oligarchs and think they're a bunch of thieves, but they don't associate theft and corruption and embezzlement with Vladimir Putin?
Well, sociologists explain that this is a kind of that, people may dislike the nachalstvo, the bosses that rule them. But the president in the Kremlin, the Tsar, is a kind of divine figure somehow. And allegiance to him equals allegiance to Russia. If you're Russian, if you're for Russia, that means you should be for Putin because he's the symbol of Russia.
So that.
But if things change, that could also change in authoritarian kind of states. The rulers, semi-czars, are always very popular. Well, I mean, that's what the official figures say, and that's maybe how it is. But when they fall, they just fall on their face, and everyone turns away. I mean, it happens. It seemed for quite a time that Saddam Hussein was massively popular with Iraqis, and Gaddafi with the Libyans and Milosevic with the Serbs. But when they fell, no one really cared much about them anymore. It's not that we are a kind of democratic state where people consider politicians or guys that are there for some time to do a job better or worse, but they will and should be changed and replaced. We are in an authoritarian dictatorship where the overall ruler is practically a divine figure. You either support him, or when he falls, you despise him because he didn't really do the job good, it turned out.
So the fact that Putin is able to spin this idea that the West is out to topple him and that all this Panama Papers stuff and the evidence of corruption that even involves his own spokesman, Peskov's wife, they believe, again, it's a plot against Putin, and Putin is so popular, and the idea that the West is plotting to topple him makes him even more popular. So it's a self-fulfilling...
I would say that I don't believe that it's his spinning it. I think he believes it, actually. He really believes that he's under attack, that he's been threatened personally, he and his family, and of course he believes that he is Russia, as any ruler who's ruled for 15 years, 16 years. And so I don't think he's spinning it. He believes it. What the people believe, I think they right now are just sort of listening. For them, $1 billion, $1 million, or $1,000, $10,000 are kind of sums that are just simply a lot of money. They don't maybe know fully the difference or understand them because in their own households they don't have anything like that. The ruling elite is the kind of nomenclatura. It has its own problems, and its problems also with the regime. They don't like what's happening, but they can't really organize, and they don't have any way of changing much. Well, because right now this kind of quarrel with the West, and they have money in the West, this demand by the regime that they bring all their money back, close offshore connections, which apparently does not spread to Putin's friends, but actually others most likely are under pressure to do so to some extent. And the problem that anyone can be arrested, and any middle-ranking official can be arrested, and his assets seized by the investigators, by the kind of the different kind of things that grew out of the former KGB, that no one is really secure. And of course they don't like that, but they can't do much. The people most likely don't give, not that they don't give a damn, they just look at it as something happening behind the screen. It's not connected directly to their lives. Their lives, what's happening with them, that's also very serious because Russia is sinking into a kind of crisis economic. Lots of things are closing down. People are losing work. Salaries are falling. Household incomes fell 10% and continue to decline. A lot of people are more or less in kind of panic. They're trying to find a way to survive. They're cutting expenses. And that, of course, in its own right, depresses the economy because households are spending less and less trying to survive on lesser incomes. That means the GDP is going down, and there's no buying spree that was in the 2000s, in the rich years of high oil prices. So the economic situation is getting from bad to worse. That will most likely increasingly affect what the people think and their attitude to authorities and to Putin personally. And of course, he also understands that that's a dangerous situation, and most likely he believes that the West wants to use that to change the regime.
So with these approaching elections, parliamentary elections in September for the state Duma, is there any chance that there will be an upset? The last Duma elections in December 2011, there were a number of street protests, I think the biggest in the country since the Soviet era. And, you know, I know that Navalny is very much a minority figure, and his liberal-leaning, the party called Russia Without Putin, probably doesn't have a lot of traction. But the fact that Putin's formed a new homeland security-type police department, some analysts in the West have said he's preparing to crack down on the elections, or if the elections are attended by protests. So let's start with the new police force. Do you see that as
it's not a police force. It's a kind of Praetorian Guard. It's a police force with air force and tanks.
I see.
So it's not the police force per se. It takes in together heavy armed army units and special riot police, which is kind of paramilitary. But these are paramilitary units that were used not only for against riots, but also as crack infantry in wars like in Chechnya. And it's all kind of pooled together into one new super military organization of up to 400,000 men.
Well, it sounds like a Republican
Guard. It will be under the Kremlin direct and will be commanded by Putin's personal bodyguard, who's now Army four-star general. So he's a professional bodyguard. He's not military. He's not, per se, he's not a policeman. He's a bodyguard from St. Petersburg, a guy from St. Petersburg, who apparently Putin considers to be totally loyal. And this new super agency should most likely be primarily used to suppress any kind of internal dissent, internal enemies. And yes, there is a problem there. After the Duma elections in December 11, there were massive protests in Moscow primarily, and it turned out that the authorities were ill-prepared for them. The riot police in Moscow was not enough in numbers, just about 2,000. They couldn't cope. They had to bus and fly in by air reinforcements from all over Russia, from Siberia, from Far East, from Urals, from all over. And these units were not really kind of rehearsed to act together. Interior ministry troops were out mostly conscripts. Young boys of just 18 and from the provinces, and not very kind of bulky guys, just kind of small, skinny people from lower income families, actually. Maybe didn't have a good malnutrition, maybe to some extent. I mean, those who couldn't pay a bribe to dodge the draft. And this kind of conglomeration was not very well prepared for well-rehearsed riot control. So now they're trying to do the thing better, to prepare a mobile unified force with heavy weapons that could fight, if need be, regular army battles, and if need be, can suppress demonstrations, and all under the command of a total loyalist. So it's a kind of Praetorian Guard thing.
It does sound more like the Republican Guard of Saddam Hussein and the Assad regime in Syria. But just in closing, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer,
Or maybe like the SS in Germany.
okay. But if there's a couple... first of all, Putin used WikiLeaks as his defense in his press conference the other day about the Panama Papers, saying that WikiLeaks have said that they are a part of the Western intelligence operation, which, you know, there's been a lot of suspicion for some time now that WikiLeaks is funded by the FSB. They've never criticized Russia, but that's, as I say, a rumor. Is your understanding that is there a connection between Has WikiLeaks been sort of co-opted by Putin?
There could be. I don't know. Of course, FSB, again, maybe, I don't know. But it's, I mean, we have different kinds of intelligence organizations, and money can come from, I mean, it's FSB is basically the equivalent of the FBI, sort of.
Right.
I mean, its main goal is internal, not external.
Right. Well, maybe.
So I don't know anything about FSB being connected to WikiLeaks.
Yeah.
But Russian kind of Kremlin different special services were very keen to extend viewers into the West to find so-called agents of influence to corrupt officials, politicians, journalists, businessmen, hoping that this would allow Russia to promote its agenda. And Europe was one of the main objectives, too. And, of course, different kind of hackers and hacktivists would also be a prime target.
More likely to be the SVR rather than the FSB. But just in closing, what are there anybody in Russia talking about the latest rumors of that Putin's new girlfriend is Rupert Murdoch's ex-wife, Wendy Deng?
Didn't hear about that. Sorry.
Well, I know we're descending into tabloid journalism here, but it's a
story. No, I didn't hear about that, no, truly.
Yeah, well, it's fairly widespread rumor over here, and she certainly has a record of seducing powerful men. So stay tuned, okay?
Okay.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenau from Moscow, where he's a defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences. And from 1994 to 2005, he published a regular column on defense in the English language local daily, The Moscow Times. 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenau joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. His regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking with James Carroll, a former priest, civil rights worker, anti-war activist and community organizer, about the Pope's new apostolic exhortation, The Joy of Love. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Carroll, a distinguished writer in residence at New York University and the author of 11 novels and 7 works of nonfiction, a former priest who has been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer. He served as a Catholic chaplain at Boston University from 1969 to 1974, and then left the priesthood to become a writer. He was named the best columnist by the Catholic Press Association and received the first Thomas Merton Award. And his latest book is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age, now out in a new paperback edition. And his latest article at The New Yorker is The New Morality of Pope Francis. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Carroll.
Ian, it's good to be with you.
Likewise, James, and your piece in The New Yorker starts out with your experience back in 1969 as a priest. And, of course, at that time, the encyclical Humanae Vitae, the Vatican's condemnation of artificial birth control, came out. And you begin your piece by talking about the challenges that brought to you, during the swinging 60s and how you had to deal with it. And my sense is that when you do, when any authorities come up with a something that's unworkable, like, for example, prohibition was in the 1930s, prohibition, of course, undermined the rule of law and undermined authority. So was that your sense of what happened with that particular encyclical on artificial birth control?
Well, yes, it's a good analogy. I think that there's always a tension between ideal principles and concrete situations. And I think moral maturity is the capacity to negotiate the way in which ideal principles apply or don't apply in concrete situations. And sometimes laws or doctrines officially promulgated can be so out of touch with the realities of the concrete situations human beings face that they can become corrosive of the authority of law in general. And that's certainly what happened with prohibition, but it's also what happened in the Catholic context with the condemnation in 1968 of so-called artificial birth control. And like many priests of my generation, I didn't believe that condemnation, and I didn't enforce it in the off-the-record, as we call them, private forum conversations I had with my Catholic parishioners. I was a chaplain at a university, and young people often sought my advice about decisions they were confronted with, and I always encouraged them in the private forum of the confessional, for example, to be responsible in their choices, which of course meant mostly using contraception, especially if one was serious about avoiding abortion, as a Catholic, of course, I was. I think that what's important about what Pope Francis has just done is that he has acknowledged this tension between general principles and specific situations, but he's brought this out of the shadows of Catholic life and said explicitly that people have the duty, obligation, and one could say privilege of ultimately applying general principles to their situations. And in that context, he effectively encourages divorced and remarried Catholics, making their own conscientious decision about it, to return to communion, which was the presenting issue of the Synod on the Family, which the Pope was responding to. But the principle, of course, goes across the board. It doesn't apply just to divorce and remarriage. It applies to all kinds of concrete human choices made in the light of general principles that may or may not apply.
Well, it does seem that the Pope's new apostolic exhortation, the joy of love, is more of a call for love to prevail over judgment than a change in the Catholic Church's rules, many of which, of course, as we just discussed, the laity ignore. But in terms of the criticism, while welcoming divorced couples back, while turning no one away, except those who want to get married, who are non-traditional, if you will, gays and lesbians. So how do you address that?
Well, the Pope is a traditional and in many ways conservative figure. He's hardly a liberal. What I'm suggesting is he's doing something that is more radical. In this exhortation, you're absolutely right. It does nothing to dismantle the egregious misogyny and homophobia that have corrupted Catholic tradition for a long time. But what he's doing is putting in play a method of moral discernment that will allow people, men, women, gay people, people who find themselves in other ways at odds with official church teaching, allow them to come to conclusions of their own about how they live and what choices they make. In other words, he's not changing the rules, he's not changing doctrine particularly, but he is very much changing the way we think about it. He himself said, and this is a quote, that this is in relationship to divorce and remarriage, that their choices, quote, are not to be determined by a new set of general rules, canonical in nature and applicable to all cases. In other words, he's not issuing new rules, but by, as he puts it, a responsible personal and pastoral discernment of particular cases. Ian, the Pope, is inviting people to act according to conscience, to apply the principles of the Church and Church teaching, but to be responsible about this, how they decide those principles apply in their own lives. And my argument is that whether the Pope intends it or not, this way of thinking about morality advances the liberalization of traditional church strictures against gay people, women, other people who are somehow misfits in the life of the church. In other words, people are invited to be responsible for themselves, to take charge of themselves, to get married if you're a gay person, and continue to affirm your central place in the life of the church. My clear reading of this document, and that's what makes it so positive. It's what makes it a real step forward. And in my opinion, it's less important whether the Pope himself would come to conclusions that agree with the choices that people, gay people, for example, might themselves make. But the Pope is clearly on record as refusing the role of being judgmental about the decisions people make. He's, in other words, allowing other people to be other people, which is the core meaning of pluralism.
And again, I'm speaking with James Carroll, a distinguished writer in residence at New York University, a former priest who has been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer. His latest book is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age, and he has an article at The New Yorker, The New Morality of Pope Francis. So, James, you talk about this it's not an encyclical. As you've described,
technically called an exhortation.
Exhortation. Right.
It's kind of hard to keep the categories of papal
right, but you compare it in scope, compassion, and eloquence and wisdom to last spring's climate change document. So, elaborate on that, if you will.
Well, I don't know how many of your listeners had the opportunity to read the fantastic climate change document that was published last May, Laudato Si, it was called. But it was a breathtakingly humane look, not just at the environmental catastrophe that looms ahead of us, but at the broad human sources of that catastrophe. It was especially a prophetic linking of the plight of the poor and the impoverished to the global economy, which, while casting aside billions of human beings, is also laying havoc to the environment. Pope Francis, more than anybody else that I'm aware of, has really connected the dots between basic unjust social structures and the broad consequences they have, not just in the lives of individual human beings, billions of people who are at the mercy of this growing gulf between the rich and the poor, for example, but also the consequences facing our planet. Laudato Si was at the same time a profound affirmation of the human capacity to confront a problem and respond creatively to it. So the effect of this very harsh look at the degradation of the planet, the effect of it was empowering, to really enable people to understand that we can change this situation for the good. And I would say that there was something similar now in this new exhortation called in English The Joy of Love, because it's a broad look at the whole range of experiences human beings have in families. And there's a long and profound meditation on the meaning of sexual love between partners, whether those the Pope doesn't get into sexual love between partners of the same sex, but the astonishingly sensitive, and I would say wise, understanding of the long, the lifelong evolution of real deep concern for one another. The document, in other words, establishes a context of such affirmation and such respect for human experience that it then, when it then takes up the moral conundrum of hard choices that people are faced with, whether to stay together, whether a woman being abused by an abusive husband should stay with him, absolutely not. The Pope understands the kind of situation such a person would find herself in, and basically affirms her absolute right to choose life, to choose to put her own welfare first. And but his analysis of that moral choice is rooted in a very beautiful appreciation of the possibilities of human love. So I encourage your listeners to read The Joy of Love. It's a beautiful statement.
Well, just in the last few minutes, James Carroll, clearly the Pope is not an ideologue. He's a pragmatist. And as you mentioned, on his plane ride back from Mexico, he talked about the Zika virus and the pandemic that it is causing in Central and South America, that it requires a change in church's policies on contraception. So just touch on that, if you will, and also on Bernie Sanders, whether or not he was invited by the Pope or not seems to be in contention, but he's certainly going to a Vatican conference, and it might well do him some good with the Catholic vote in both Pennsylvania and New York.
Yes, well, first, on contraception, that's a good example of what I'm talking about. The Church has condemned contraception. The Catholic people have chosen to practice contraception, and now we finally see that the hierarchy itself is coming around, taking the signal from the Catholic people, which is what it means that Pope Francis has affirmed that the situation of the Zika virus requires a change in the principle of the Church's ban. So that's an instance of the very method of moral discernment I'm talking about. That Bernie Sanders would be drawn to the Vatican is a testimony to the moral authority that Pope Francis wields in the world today. It's an astonishing that in just a handful of years, a pope of all things, a pope, the head of the most traditionally understood reactionary institution on the planet, suddenly the pope emerges as a figure of affirmation, of hope, and clear assertion of the principle of justice, the important absolute refusal to allow the plight of blind people to go ignored anymore. The plight of poor people to be treated as invisible. And it's a signal of that authority that Bernie Sanders is drawn to Rome and no doubt would welcome an audience with the Pope.
Well, as he said, Bernie said, I'm a big, big fan of the Pope, and I guess he's not alone there. I thank you for joining us.
As for the Catholic vote, Ian, let me just note that the majority of Catholic Republicans in Massachusetts and other states in primaries voted for Donald Trump after Pope Francis questioned whether Donald Trump was a Christian, given his attitudes. So it's a little bit unclear to me that Pope Francis is wielding a strong political influence when it comes to American elections.
What an irony that we're talking about how liberal attitudes were kept alive in spite of conservative doctrine, and now you have a liberal pope and the conservatives
right.
still reign. Oh, well, thank you so much, James. I appreciate it.
Always great to talk to you, Ian. I wish you well.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with James Carroll, who's a distinguished writer in residence at New York University, the author of 11 novels and 7 works of nonfiction. He's a former priest who has been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer. And he served as a Catholic chaplain at Boston University from 1969 to 1974, and then left the priesthood to become a writer. He was named the best columnist by the Catholic Press Association and received the first Thomas Merton Award. And his latest book is Christ Actually the Son of God for the Secular Age, now out in paperback. And his latest article at The New Yorker is The New Morality of Pope Francis. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back getting an update on how the new rules, the deal between the EU and Turkey, working out, particularly in Greece, where asylum seekers are being held in huge pens and becoming increasingly desperate as they face deportation. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Daryl Grisgraber, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, where she focuses mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daryl Grisgraber.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me.
So, thank you for joining us, Daryl. And it's pretty clear that this deal worked out by the EU and Turkey is creating enormous problems, particularly in Greece, where Greece, or at least the island of Lesbos, is turning into a holding pen for asylum seekers who are becoming increasingly desperate as they face deportation back to Turkey. It does seem that there's certainly not enough, clearly, way not enough money being spent to address this crisis, even to deal with it in terms of the EU-Turkey deal. $4 billion have gone to Turkey, but they're only capable of absorbing 200,000 who are being returned. So it feels like this whole thing's going to come to the crunch.
Well, I can see why it appears to be going that way, but I think keep in mind that the deal has only been active, been implemented for about a week at this point. It started on April 4th, the return. That was the first day of returns. And the returns numbers have been quite low so far, 200 on Monday and a bit over 100 on Friday, 125, I believe. So we're not talking about tens of thousands of people being sent back immediately because people are making asylum claims and asking for protection. But that is, as you said, a tremendous amount of strain on Greece because it is meant to be responsible for receiving and then examining those asylum claims. And so the money, of course, is always an issue in humanitarian situations. But one of the things that's equally important in Greece is the manpower. They just don't have enough people, enough asylum officers, basically, to be handling all of these claims right now. And in addition to that, as of today, the returns back to Turkey have been suspended because people are asking for asylum like crazy, and all of those claims have to be examined. So right now, Greece is feeling the strain of trying to get all of those done. And as you said, the outlying islands, the ones closest to Turkey, are becoming basically like large detention centers where conditions are not good.
So is there a sense then that a lot of this is to do with, one, Turkey sort of, as I say, they seem to have extorted, some people argue, about $4 billion in aid from the EU. And to be fair to Turkey, Turkey has spent a lot of money so far housing refugees. But is there a problem, Daryl, in the broader sense that the EU itself doesn't have an overall policy? And here you have Greece bearing the brunt, as you just pointed out.
It is an issue, and this has been complicated for a couple of decades in the EU. The idea of a common European asylum system is something that's been in the works since the late 90s, I believe. And while steps have been made to try to harmonize what happens from country to country for asylum seekers and how their claims are processed, in the end, individual member states can set legislation and rules that that trump basically the EU's wider regulations. And so for Greece in particular, it's a small country. It's one of the countries on the border, of course. I mean, if you look at how close it is to Turkey, you can see why they'd be receiving so many of the arrivals from Turkey. And it is difficult then for them to absorb all these asylum seekers and not have people move on and be, in a sense, shared, I suppose, with the rest of Europe. But for Turkey, I mean, as you said, they've given something like $8 billion to the Syrian refugee response at this point, and you can see why they feel like they're doing quite a lot and weren't getting the response from the international community that they really wanted. But so far, you can argue that the provisions of this EU-Turkey deal are questionable, either ethically, some people say legally, hard to tell. But right now, the provisions of the agreement, everyone is abiding by them as far as we can tell. There is a question of whether some of the people returned from Greece to Turkey were in fact asylum seekers who were sent back accidentally. But in light of, or in the face of that, the returns have been suspended. So again, it's new, right? Only 1 week. And I think it really remains to be seen how things are going to continue to play out. But Greece certainly is having a hard time.
And again, I'm speaking with Daryl Grisgraber, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, focusing mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. But when we talk about the Syrian displacement crisis, for example, the latest batch, as far as I know, of refugees deported from Lesbos in Greece to Turkey. This was a ferry carrying 45 Pakistanis. Now, Pakistanis clearly are not Syrians, and they're not Afghans or not Iraqis, where in all cases there's a civil war, nothing quite as bad as in Syria itself, which is just a killing field from what we can tell, and the whole country's basically been destroyed. So how do you distinguish between refugees who seem to be economic refugees as compared to those who are literally fleeing for their lives?
Right. That's a really important question. And this conversation started about a year and a half ago when there was huge migration toward Turkey in the first place, toward Europe more generally. But refugees are people who are fleeing persecution. They're people whose own government either can't or won't protect them from human rights violations. And while it's obvious with Syria what those violations might be and why people are leaving, really important to remember that people coming from other places that aren't necessarily conflict zones can well be refugees as well. They might have political problems. They might be members of a persecuted social group. They might be members of an ethnic group that is treated poorly and whose rights are violated. So it's not really as cut and dried as saying Syrians are refugees. Other people coming from conflict zones are not. The group of people that you talked about who returned on Friday had, as you said, quite a few Pakistanis. There were Iraqis and Egyptians, Bangladeshis in that group as well. And, well, Iraq arguably is a conflict zone, but for example, Bangladesh or Egypt, you could say that these are not the areas where people are fleeing war, but they're still certainly fleeing significant human rights violations. And this is exactly what asylum processes are for, to figure out who is actually a refugee and needs protection and who is not and might be coming for other reasons.
Well, it would seem sort of logical in a way that the best solution would be to end the Syrian civil war.
Sure.
And there's some efforts being made in that direction now, but they're rather halting and certainly not to be relied on. But Second best would be, I imagine, to house people, as is happening in Jordan and Turkey, next to the very country that they hope to return to. Although every day that passes, returning to a country that's being systematically dismantled and destroyed, with little hope that there's any kind of reconciliation in the wind. But nevertheless, that seems a logical approach. You'd think that the Europeans would be more disposed to helping Turkey and Jordan keep these refugees close to their home country as opposed to have them come to Europe. So what is your understanding of the prevailing, given how much a lot of countries, for example, like Hungary, behave very badly in the big exodus last year? What's your sense of whether or not that is a prevailing wisdom, if you will?
Well, unfortunately, in Europe, I think there was plenty of attention on the Syria crisis that really increased in the past couple of years when all of this migration across the Mediterranean started. And so really what we're looking at there is that once it became a crisis on their own territory, EU started paying a bit more attention. And unfortunately, this is probably not unusual. If many more Syrian refugees were showing up directly in the United States, it would probably get a lot more directed attention from the U.S. government and policymakers than it does right now, which is not to say it's being ignored. Of course, you probably know all about the debate about resettlement of Syrians in the U.S. So I think Europe has kind of caught up to the fact that this is affecting everyone everywhere, not just Syria and the surrounding countries. And they're now trying to see what they can do to make some of that work. The money that they're giving to Turkey, at least some of it, is meant to be humanitarian in support of Syrian refugees in Turkey. And there are lots of countries around the world, including many EU member states, that are, in fact, contributing to the response in Jordan and in Lebanon. The problem there is that for a long time now, Syrians have been stuck in these countries, some of them for up to 5 years at this point. And if they don't see a future for themselves in those countries, no matter how good the aid coming in is, they might have enough to eat. They might have a place to live. But if they don't see a future, particularly what they always tell us is education for their children and the prospect of earning a living, there are many professionals among the Syrian refugee population who would like to practice their skills. If those things are not as available to them, they're likely to keep on moving. So you're right in that Europe needs to be offering help to keep people maintain their well-being in Turkey, in Jordan, in Lebanon. But a lot of what that comes down to now is not just the emergency system, it's assistance. It's things like making sure the educational system is working and that jobs are being created so that Syrians can work and support themselves.
Well, apparently an estimated 80% of Syrian refugee children in Turkey are unable to attend school.
Right, and that's something that we've been looking at for a while, but to be fair, Turkey is making steps toward trying to fix that. They have a number of programs in place now. They're running a second shift, and it's possible sometimes to have alternative Syrian schools, and they really are focusing, as is the international community this year, on how to start making education for kids in particular happen more effectively. This is part of what the No Lost Generation movement is all about, if you're familiar with that, just to make sure that all of these Syrian kids who are missing out on education are not eventually going to become basically forgotten children who have slipped through the cracks. So, but these changes take place so slowly in Turkey. And really, they would take place slowly anywhere. But Turkey has been very cautious about handling the Syrian refugee response on its own and about whom it is allowing into the country to help. And it's very deliberate in how it considers how these things are going to move forward. And so, unfortunately, in the meantime, Syrians are feeling that pressure of not always being included and are migrating as well. But it's important to keep in mind, we talk about the Syrian refugee crisis in Europe, and we're looking at over 1 million people, of course, but there are almost 5 million Syrian refugees who've remained in the region. So the huge, huge bulk of them are still not making it to Europe. They are in the regional countries, and that's where we really need to be focusing as well on what's being done for them.
But under the terms of this EU-Turkey deal, my understanding is that the EU will house one of the more than 2.5 million Syrian refugees residing in Turkey for every irregular refugee returned from Greece to Turkey's shores. How's that going to work out, particularly now that you said only such a small number have so far been returned, and many of them aren't Syrian?
Yeah, well, and that's an important point to remember. This one-for-one deal where for every refugee returned, one will be resettled, applies only to Syrians. It's hard to say how that is going to sift out at the moment, because it seems like more and more people in the past week who've arrived, and arrivals are much lower, I should add, are making asylum claims. And it can take some time for those claims to be examined and for a decision to be issued. So in the meantime, ideally, under normal international regulations, those people can't be returned to Turkey until there's a decision on their claim, their asylum claim. And people also have the right to an appeal of a negative decision in this process in Greece. So realistically, there are going to be quite a lot of people held up, I suppose you could say, in Greece, because they're waiting to hear what the outcomes of these claims are. And as you can see, in the past week, there have only been about, 300, 350 returns from Greece to Turkey. So we're not talking about the enormous volume, I think, that everyone was anticipating right from the beginning. And I suppose a lot will depend on how quickly Greece can continue to examine claims and make decisions. That will very much affect how fast people are returned. But again, I think it's important to remember Syrians and many, many other nationalities have legitimate claims for international protection. I think people are probably going to be surprised at how many of these people are, in fact, legitimate refugees in need of protection and not what we're calling economic migrants.
Well, then, just in the last couple of minutes, Daryl Grisgraber, we were mentioning a while ago how the this refugee crisis, obviously its source, at least in large part, is Syria. And if to attack the problem at its roots, you have to end that horrible, long and bloody civil war, and that's a pretty heavy lift. And so far, the Europeans, I don't think they've been that helpful. It seems like Russia and America are trying at the moment to come up with a deal. The Iranians and the Saudis and others and Turkey have been pouring fuel on the fire, and as arguably has the US. All parties are pouring arms in. But not necessarily peacemakers. But the other aspect to it is that this refugee crisis in Europe has created some very ugly political trends in Europe itself, with the rise of far right-wing parties getting more and more traction. So not only is it imperative to end the Syrian civil war, it would seem to be an imperative to end the refugee crisis so that Europe doesn't turn back to the 1930s.
Well, that's probably true on the surface, but I think, in Europe there are policies and processes in place, politically as well, that make Europe capable of sort of handling this situation, where I think things in Syria, for example, are quite a lot more chaotic. It's probably more important to focus on what's happening in Syria right now and for Syrian civilians, because I think political processes in other countries affected by this, including by having large numbers of Syrian refugees arrive, have ways of working these things out that, ideally are not going to involve civil war. I think our focus as an international community and giving support where it's needed still needs to focus on the root of the conflict in Syria.
Well, Daryl Grisgraber, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Daryl Grisgraber, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, focusing mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.